This podcast is supported by Washington.org. Washington, D.C. offers visitors so much to explore. Just ask Dayo, who shared her experiences from a recent visit.
What was your favorite food all weekend?
The Ethiopian food at Sihei.
And the first place you would visit again?
The bookstore, Little District Books.
What did you appreciate the most?
Really just like the genuine kindness of everyone that I encountered this weekend.
Why should people visit D.C.?
Well, D.C. is a place with such a thriving culture.
Washington, D.C. has something for everybody. Plan your next trip at Washington.org.
Hey, everyone. It's Estelle Herndon, political reporter for The New York Times. When I became a journalist, I made a promise to my readers, like the way that doctors take an oath to their patients. I committed to bringing the truth to light, no matter which party, business, organization, or person I'm reporting on. I have to be persistent. I have to do research, and I have to push back when someone tries to hide or spin the facts. And I know I'm going to write stories that both Democrats and Republicans don't like. But that's what The New York Times has been doing for more than a century. And that's what we're going to keep doing. We believe the public deserves the right to make up their mind based on the facts. So if you want to support this kind of work, you can subscribe to The New York Times at nytimes.com/subscribe.
It's another week. We are back. This is Popcast Deluxe, your combination of weekly cultural review. I am John Caramonica.
I'm Joe Coscarelli.
Joe, it's been a big week. It's been a huge week. We are going to talk about Barbie. Regrettably, neither of us saw Oppenheimer.
It's true, but I
saw an ops cam, but I did not see an Oppenheimer.
Yeah, we're going to get to this. I did the real doubleheader.
You really did.
For the weekend.
Mine was spread out.
Instead of chasing Barbie with Oppenheimer.
Like Quentin Tarantino crossing the street to buy a ticket. Yeah.
I chased Barbie with Drake. Femininity, masculinity.
Nice guy misogyny. A little dose of
the
nice
crossover
guy.
Crossover of the two.
Honestly, yeah. Two nice guy misogyny moments. Two great tastes.
He's just Ken.
Boy, wow. He's enough. So we're going to talk about the Barbie film. We are not going to talk about Oppenheimer, maybe on a later day, TBD. We're going to talk about the Drake tour. Yep. We both saw Drake tour. I saw it at Barclays. Joe saw it at the Garden.
Yeah.
There's been a little, we're going to have a little culture war news. Jason Aldean, not too much, just a sprinkle.
Just a taste of culture war.
Yeah. On regular podcast this week, we do a full episode on the Aldean situation, but we're just going to kind of get into some of the mechanics going on here. We got songs of the week. We got question of the week, touching on 50 rappers. We got snacks. I'm wearing pink in my own way. Some of us were wearing pink long before Barbie.
Did you wear pink to see Barbie?
No, I didn't wear pink to see Barbie, but I did wear pink today. Well, you know, it's a little showing up.
Yeah, just little touches.
If you know, you know.
Yeah.
We're out here wearing pink. So I saw Barbie. I saw it with the Styles desk. Actually, you saw it with...
I went solo to
no.
Barbie.
You went solo?
So all black. Solo. E1 34th Street
wow.
Theater.
Wow.
Just me and the people.
No, I saw it with the Styles desk, but theater bought out. Bought out.
So you saw a private screening of Barbie.
That's one way to think about it.
And were our colleagues from the Styles desk Barbied out?
A few of them were. I don't want to name names. You know who you are. But like a few of them were actually. I will say like I did miss something not seeing this with, not that people in the Styles desk weren't like true enthusiasts,
yeah.
But I think you do lose something not seeing it with people who are just like, I'm here with the cowboy hat and the pink dress and the so on and so forth.
Yes.
On a top line, okay, so my vibe on the film, very rarely have I seen a movie that constantly
very won. Rarely have I seen a movie
period. That said, very rarely have I seen a movie that constantly wants to remind you that it is a movie, and boy did we get away with making this movie.
Yes.
And it's like there is no formal breaking of the fourth wall, like you're right, very briefly
we'll
with
get
the voice
that.
The voiceover thing. Yeah. Right, very very briefly, also out of place, but there's not, okay, it doesn't rely on fourth wall breaking in any classic sense, but to me, the fourth wall breaking in this film was the constant, like, did you see what we just did?
Yeah.
Did you see the joke we just made?
Yeah.
Did you see the reference? Did you see the outfit? And so I didn't feel like I was watching a movie so much as like the DVD bonus director's footage voiceover, just not voice, because it was somehow embedded in the film. And that made it a little less enjoyable. I mean, you know, I thought it was fine and amusing, but I felt like I was watching commentary about the making of the Barbie film more than I was watching the Barbie film.
Yeah, it felt like a strung together compilation of SNL skits about making a Barbie
about
movie.
Making a Barbie, yes. Again, about making a Barbie
and
film.
And I think that in some ways the meta textures of the movie worked in so far as Greta Gerwig, the director and writer with her partner Noah Baumbach, I think she was drawing a pretty direct line between what it's like to play with dolls, where you're the auteur, you're making a story, you know, you can
make them do whatever,
wherever you want. They're a reflection of your inner happiness, your inner pain, etc. And I think, you know, when you get to the sort of monologues, the expository tying in a bow monologues at the end, it's very much like, the moral of this movie is we tell ourselves stories in order not to die.
Yes.
You know, like that's the, that it's very much about storytelling and making. So that I thought was fine. But I also, it never let you forget that it was a movie about a doll, because it was constantly being like, can you believe we made a movie about a doll with the approval of the corporation, but still got to say X, Y, and Z?
Right. And some of that X, Y, and Z is being playful about gender, being playful about visual representation. And some of it is like poking fun at corporate management and sort of like the Mattel guys are the bad guy. And they're
but
all guys,
really.
But they're not, but they don't end up as bad guys. But like they're sort of, you know, I mean, it's Will Ferrell, so like obviously it undermines the bad guy concept, but like the idea that there's just 10 men in suits on the top floor of some building being like, this is what young girls like,
right.
Playing with that. Obviously, the Mattel building is all gray and everything out in the world is pink or otherwise colorful. I just found it ultimately, it was too winky and it felt like imbalance. Like you mentioned the monologues towards the end. I mean, we can lightly spoil, I think. The premise of the Barbie movie is that there's a real world in a Barbie land and you can kind of move between them should you need to, or should there be a reason to.
Though it screws things up if you rip a hole between the universes.
Before, which would necessitate the kind of moving across the border. And so actually, can we play? This is a sentence I'm never, ever going to say again. Or before, probably. But can we play that Tame Impala record?
Yeah.
We'll get to the soundtrack in a minute, but Journey to the Real World is what it's called. And it is the music that plays when Barbie is journeying to the real world. And actually, I think it's quite good.
I'm shocked.
I'm shocked. I would rather not know it's Tame Impala.
Right.
I'm like, sort of like, it's kind of like harshes my mellow a little bit. The thing that I think was challenging for me narratively, so much happens in the second half of the film that you, if you're willing to kind of grant the film its frivolities in the first half, which is fine. I don't need it to be Godard. You know what I mean? Like I'm willing to grant it that. But the second half, it's like serious expository musical numbers, long speeches from at least two characters, political intrigue between the uprising of the Kens versus the takeovers of the bar, like all of this stuff crammed in the last like 25 minutes of the film.
Yeah.
And then I'm like, well, what was I like, if this is what the movie was about, what was I watching for the first hour? I was watching a bunch of jokes, a bunch of winks, a bunch of like meta text.
Really good setup. Like the opening scenes in the Barbie world, really funny and thrilling. The opening scenes in the real world as Barbie and Ken are discovering patriarchy and catcalling and that construction workers are actually men and not women. You know, the joke about the Supreme Court on the billboard when it's a bunch of women in bikinis. Like all the bits in the first third, I thought, you're right, really work. But then there's so much work to do to unwind it all. Because like the movie...
Because you have to give the movie stakes.
Yes.
Like the problem is there's no stakes in the beginning. You have to give the movie stakes. And I do think look, I have not, this will not surprise you. I haven't watched a lot of Greta Gerwig films, nor a lot of Noah Baumbach films, but the idea that like seriousness and stakes only comes with a lot of words.
Yeah.
And there's ways to communicate emotion without a lot of words.
Yeah, I think this movie was well written on a line and joke level, but structured strangely.
Really, really.
When you're talking about stakes, so there's actually three sort of plot lines that might run the length of a film on its own, right? There's Barbie and Ken and their sort of pseudo romance and then power struggle politically. There's the arc of Barbie and Ken. There's the arc of Barbie and her relation to her owner, the people in the real world who are taking care of her, who she believes to be a teenage girl.
America Ferrera.
And then is, her actually, daughter, is actually the
who's
mother.
Who's in the new metal.
Who's into new metal.
Definitely in a new metal. Yeah,
the daughter is into new metal. This daughter does not. The daughter is an Oppenheimer, not a Barbie.
For sure.
And then the third sort of driving plot is the screw ups in the real world because of Barbie crossing over and Mattel basically chasing her and trying to put her back in
the box.
So I thought some of those threads get played out more and more cleverly than others. For instance, I thought the Barbie versus Ken, you know, Ken comes to the real world, discovers that men are in charge, returns home and takes over Barbie's dream house and makes it a man cave.
Can you name what it is?
Mojo.
Dojo.
Dojo.
Casa House.
Close. Sure.
Sure.
Great.
Great.
I thought that was really good. Some people have pointed out that Ken's plotline sort of stands in for feminism in a double reverse kind of way, where in fact, the infighting is then their downfall. You know, that there's like a little bit of like a wink there and you can track it with the feminist movement.
Really looking forward to the Barbie reader put out on like the University of Chicago Press 4 years from now.
But then, for instance, the Mattel plot line with Will Ferrell and his goons chasing Barbie and Ken to make sure they go back to the dreamland. Then all of a sudden, like the Ken house is their bestseller. Like that plot line is like thrown into the ether, but never really wrapped up or like, you know, and then the mother daughter thing is supposed to be what like the emotional core of the movie, since Barbie and Ken don't have an actual love story.
But also the thing with the mother daughter is, and this was what I was struck by, is by the end of the film, the daughter who is new metal, you know, was new metal before.
Yeah. Daughter.
We're shorthanding here. All of a sudden is wearing, you know, like a shift dress or whatever.
Yeah.
And is, you know, affectionate towards her mother, where she had not been affectionate towards her mother. But I'm never quite clear about what happened that precipitated that change in the daughter, besides the sense that like she saw her mother inspire Barbie to like retake Barbie land.
Yeah.
That was never explored. And to be honest, the opening scene with the daughter where she's like reading Barbie and basically being like, this is what you did wrong. At the lunch table, this is what you did wrong. This is how
she
you
calls
ruined
her fascist.
Like you basically undermined feminism, et cetera, et cetera. I was like, oh, where's that energy?
Right. And mom gets her sort of feminist unloading monologue, you know, that convinces all of the Barbies to take their world back from Ken. You know, I think there was so much packed into this, both visually, plot-wise,
somehow under 2 hours, joke-wise,
and still came in under 2 hours. I felt like, you know, it felt like a lot of notes were given, but they also wanted to let the creators still have their creative freedom. You know what I mean? It was like, it was trying to be all things to all people. And I think at the end, it sort of threw up its hands, both politically and in a film sense.
Well, okay. The Greta Gerwig profile where she, in the magazine?
Times Magazine. Willa Paskin.
Yes, yep. where she says repeatedly, like, why are they letting me get away with this?
Yeah. That felt like the energy of the movie.
Yes, but also, not to be all like, let me tell you about creativity, not to be like that. But it's like, if you are still operating under the framework of I'm being allowed to get away with this, are you getting away with anything? And like, there's a lot of things in here that like challenge traditional Barbieism, right?
Yes.
But does it challenge traditional Barbieism in any meaningful way?
And it sort of asks itself that in the movie.
It's doing it and ongoing, yeah. but then that makes me wonder, like, is that in fact what's happening
right. here
in any meaningful way?
Right.
I don't know that it is.
Yeah.
Like, I feel that maybe the real question is, do you walk out of this film more likely to purchase a Barbie doll for someone that you care about than you walked into the film? Because I think if you're one of the goons in the Mattel building, that is the only meaningful question. There's the side thing of like turning Mattel into kind of like an IP machine in the same way that Disney might be or Pixar. But that to me is secondary. The first thing is, do Barbie sales go up or do they go down? I'm inclined to think they go up. But I think in a weird way, having someone like Greta Gerwig make this film as idiosyncratic as it is, is a very smart way for Mattel to say, look at us. We're not jamming classic stereotypical Barbieism down you. But what are we going to do? We're going to absolutely promote the out of it. We're going to market it constantly. We're going to have partnerships with every single brand you can think of. It's going to be so inescapable.
It's a monster. And it worked is the key thing. I mean, the box office is humongous. This movie far outperformed expectations. It's a bona fide cultural phenomenon. And I think that you're right. And I really wanted to, like, I wanted to let that Adbusters side of my brain go and be like, it's funny enough that it doesn't matter. It's clever. It's subversive. I could never forget that I was watching a movie about a toy owned by a conglomerate. Like, I just, like,
I guess I like you, but like, unlike you, I don't I don't care about that. Like, I, you know, like,
I don't want to care about that all the time, especially when I'm in a movie with movie stars who I love by directors and writers that I love. You know, like, I wanted it to transcend that. And I'm sympathetic to the Richard Brody view of, like, even within these parameters, it's truly revolutionary because of its creativity.
Yeah, sure.
But like, I just couldn't get there.
Can we do just like a minute on film Twitter?
Oh, yeah.
Wilding.
So on both of these films, so Oppenheimer and Barbie.
Yes. So Brody is basically like, I really like this film.
Not a sellout.
No.
She's saying Greta is not a sellout for doing this.
We're all, I mean, look, Richard Brody is old enough to know that we are all sellouts. Yeah. Richard Brody is Spawn for Richard Brody. And then Amy Tobin RTs him and his Baszler quote tweets him. Is basically like, not with, like, I forget exactly what she said, but she was basically like, oh, like, funny that the guy who wrote about Godard can't yada yada. Anyway, shots fired.
Can I read what I thought was Brody's best summation of why he thought this movie worked anyway? Like, I highlighted this line in particular. He said, Barbie, in other words, is a film of the politics of culture and by extension of the need for a creative rebellion to re-estrange the familiar for the sake of social change. Like,
drop a bomb on it.
I mean, tell Flex
to run it back and drop a bomb on it. 100%.
Yeah, like reach your hand into the cash register, Richard Brody. Like, that money is yours, you know? Like, but again, like, it didn't quite work for me. And I think, like
I'm sympathetic.
Yes, that's what I'm saying.
I want that to be true.
I wish I saw that movie.
Yeah.
And like, I was thinking the whole time about a triumvirate of other movies that are trying to do a similar thing. One, Josie and the Pussycats, which is, again, fourth wall breaking, meta, making fun of the IP-ness and sellout culture and all of that.
But also good.
Genuinely
and good.
Good
music.
And with bangers on the soundtrack, which I wish this one had a few more of, but we'll get back to that.
We'll get to that, yeah.
Elf.
Haven't seen in a long time, but yeah.
But a sort of similar thing where, you know, like basically a toy enters the real world.
Yeah, sure.
And it's about sort of the incongruity of, you know, Will Ferrell as a giant elf trying to make his way in the real world in the face of consumerism of Christmas. And Zoolander, another sort of...
All Will Ferrell.
Oh, right. And I think the casting of Will Ferrell as the Mattel executive is like a nod.
No, they were just like, Mugatu. Mugatu. Basically like, do Mugatu in a
suit.
In a Brooks Brothers suit rather than in like a Yoji suit.
Right. And I just think, and maybe it's my age, like those three movies I named came out when I was, you know, between the ages of whatever, 9 and 15, like really imprint themselves, I think, on the old millennial generation.
Yeah, sure.
And I don't know if this enters that canon, but maybe it will for younger people.
I also wonder if you are experiencing this movie not through the 7 layers of metatext that, like, obviously we are viewing it through. That's sort of why I'm saying I wish I'd seen it in a more broad-based environment, because I'm curious to know what hit. Like, the things that we were laughing at in our screening were the winky moments about the winky moments about the winky moments.
You saw it with a bunch of journalists.
Yes. But I wonder if there's, like, a bunch of, like, 15 to 25-year-olds who are just like, I dressed up and I want to have a good time. What did they laugh at?
This was really interesting to me, actually. So I saw it on, just for full context, on a Sunday evening.
Okay.
Which I think is probably less lit than the Friday night and Saturday night screenings. Yeah. Sunday evening is when hungover young people go to the movies, I think. The crowd was dead. There was not a lot of laughs, the exception being any time Ryan Gosling did anything. Like, he...
Gosling, the star of this film?
He is... I mean, I think Margot Robbie is incredible and great in everything and great in this, but he got a laugh with every gesture, every joke, every song. Like, he did it.
When the book comes out 20 years from now, and the book is called The Himbo.
Yeah.
Him in this movie is the cover photo for that book.
Yeah.
The way that he both played into it and played again, like, the sophistication of the stupidity, so high.
Yeah.
With Margot Robbie, there's a consistent earnestness, and it's hard to play earnestness for laughs at this level, I think, when there's so much winking going on around it. There's something you have to fundamentally believe that Margot Robbie / Barbie is, like...
She's the heart of the movie.
Right, and that she has, like, a pure motivation, whether the motivation is to rescue herself from cellulite or the motivation is to go out into the real world and become a real girl.
Yeah.
You have to trust the purity of that. There's nothing with Ken's character where you have to trust the purity of it.
Pure shtick.
Exactly. And so every time that he's doing it and he's winking at a level, it's almost like he's winking within the film at his performance, which is a lot of what this film is doing, is winking at the very fact of the thing itself. He's very, very good at that. Really impressive.
Margot Robbie, I will say, a great physical comedian. I thought her Barbie movements, you know, from the feet to, you know, when she sits down on the lawn and she does the sideways fall all of that, I thought was great. And I thought
two weeks in a row of great physical comedians on Popcast Deluxe. Pinky Doll, Margot Robbie.
It's
just
true.
If Pinky Doll is not in the Barbie 2, like, you know what I'm saying? Yeah. Like,
did you see Pinky Doll saying she's going to Hollywood and someone being like, I regret to inform you that Pinky Doll is a scab? Poor Pinky Doll. But the other thing I want to say about Margot Robbie and her comedy was she sold the hell out of the final line, which, like, you really needed to
nail. Okay, so this actually came up in the conversations I was having over the weekend. So there's a lot of energy around the final line on Twitter.
Yep.
I happened to be over the weekend with a lot of people. I was the only person who had seen the film. Mm. And so people are saying, like,
but they already knew about the,
well, they knew that there was, they didn't know what it was. Okay. They knew that it was, like,
right.
And they were like, was it really like, tell me, you know, like, a couple people were like, well, I'm not going to see the movie. Tell me what the final line is, blah, blah, blah. But there's so much energy on Twitter about the final line. My experience of the final line in the movie theater was not that this is a 10. I was sort of like, it's like maybe like a tiny bit like, wah, wah, like, how was it? How did you receive it? And how did the group that you saw it with receive it?
Again, my crowd was not
in it.
Like, not in the movie. It was quite young. Some people dressed up, but it wasn't riotous. You know what I mean? At all. Nobody was outwardly having a great time. And it didn't, I don't think it landed, but it made me smile. Mm-hmm. Even though I had some sense of where it was going.
Sure.
From the chatter, it worked for me. It was punctuation.
Yeah, it was punctuation. Like, again, because this film felt inconsistent, I think there would have been a way to sprinkle the film with 2, 3, or 4 moments that actually then laid the runway for that final line. But to my ear and eye, maybe there's one very real moment in the film that sets the table for it and one kind of like half moment. So I think by the time you arrived at that final line, in a way, you've almost forgotten. I feel like the context of it is like a tiny bit forgotten, because the real part where it refers back to it is in the first 20 minutes of the film.
Yeah.
So, it's funny. It's final line. It's funny, but it didn't quite hit as hard as I thought, as people seem to think it would hit on Twitter, or people on Twitter seem to think it hit.
I want to talk about the way music functions in this movie, but maybe we should listen to a little bit of Pink from the Barbie soundtrack. Is that Lizzo's song?
Lizzo getting it in.
Kind of funny song.
Yeah.
Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made or how a wooden table is built piece by piece. And in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
This is A.O. Scott. I'm a critic at the New York Times. What I do and what the other critics here do is part of the same project that all of the journalists at the New York Times work on every day, to give you clarity and perspective, and above all, a deeper understanding of the world. When you subscribe to the New York Times, it's not just here are the headlines, but here's the way everything fits together. If you'd like to subscribe, please go to nytimes.com/subscribe.
So music in the film, to your point, functions two different ways. There are original songs, Barbie themed, pegged to certain plot segments in the film.
And comedic.
Yes, that are written by some of the biggest pop music songwriters and performed by some of the biggest pop music performers. So Pink by Lizzo.
You got Charlie XCX on here. You got...
I've said some of the biggest.
You got...
Billie Eilish.
Billie Eilish is here. Doing a tearjerker.
Your boy Dominic Fike is here. Yep.
Got invited to the party.
Heavy. Dua Lipa, who is also in the movie. I also did not catch it until I saw the credits. Is that what you were about to say?
No, you didn't know it was Dua?
I didn't. It just...
People have been making fun of her wig for weeks on Twitter.
I guess I'm not on... You're I think your follow or...
My For You?
For You feed is so much more sinister than my For You
feed. It's because I'm a mischievous liker.
I can't even imagine what goes on in the algorithm when it sees you liking a tweet. There's like 20 like people working the algorithm, like somewhere in the offices of X, somewhere being like, Joe liked it. Let's serve him. Let's serve him the wildest stuff we can find. Yeah, I don't like anything on Twitter.
So the Dua song is in the film, and it soundtracks the Barbie beach house party that happens every night
near the
beginning of the movie, which I thought worked better and was a funnier use of Dua than her actual appearance in the film, which she has one line, but I feel like she struggled with it a little bit with the line reading.
Truly, on God, did not realize it was Dua until the credits.
It is. I do like when she serves John Cena beer in the waves. The second Dua cameo was better than the first for me. But then there's some throwback songs, let's say.
So the biggest laugh by far when I saw it was the first deployment of Matchbox 20 Push. And that song is being used as this kind of de facto,
it's the male national anthem.
This is what men think. This is what they feel. This is how they communicate their dominance.
Yeah.
But in an affectionate way.
Yeah.
And it is the performance of Push by Matchbox 20. I read a Rob Thomas interview.
Which is a crazy sentence.
I had a lot of crazy sentences in this episode. I read a Rob Thomas interview. And Rob Thomas said, Rob Thomas, I don't know Rob Thomas. I want to clarify. I don't know Rob Thomas personally. Rob Thomas is probably very rich.
Unbelievable.
Super rich.
Man, it's
you
a hot one.
You cannot touch him. You can't touch him.
No.
You can't break Rob.
Supernatural has sold like 500 bazillion copies.
You can't hurt Rob Thomas. He's unhurtable.
Yeah.
he says in the interview, oh, you know, I heard they wanted to use it as like a Ken anthem. I totally assumed I'd be the butt of the joke. The song would be the butt of the joke. And I was fine with that. I'm essentially used to being the butt of the joke as I count my millions. Like, he's like, I'm good. And then he's like, someone I work with saw a screening of it and was like, actually, it's kind of cool how they use it. And blah, blah, blah. Like, yes, still the butt of the joke, yes, obviously. Right. And it was by far the loudest laugh. The first, like, the minute it's, I want to push you around.
Yeah.
The minute that happens, everybody in the theater lost it. Genuinely a beautiful moment of music supervision, I thought. Really, really impressive.
Can I do another music business corner sidebar,
of course.
Is that if you go on streaming services this Monday morning after seeing Barbie and you want to listen to Push by Matchbox 20, not only have they re-released Push with fresh Barbie-themed artwork,
pink artwork,
great, but they packaged it with a B-side. So if you play Push, you're going to get a second Matchbox 20 song after it. Old, I believe. But a little A-side, B-side, Push Barbie themed.
Is there any connection of the second song to the first song?
I don't believe so, but mostly it's a fun. It's just like, you might also like, if you want to listen to Matchbox 20.
It's an R-I-Y-L? Yeah. Crazy.
Which I thought,
if you like patriarchy, it's literally like recommended if you like patriarchy.
But quite savvy of whoever at Matchbox 20's label is like, all right, we're about to see a boost. Okay, but I want to compare the use of Matchbox 20's Push to the sort of inverse, which is the feminine song in the film, and that's Indigo Girls' Closer to Fine.
One of the great songs in the American songbook.
Right. So, I mean, let's just listen to a little bit of Closer to Fine. So this song plays a handful of times.
It plays, in addition to the Tame Impala record, it plays when there's the going back and forth.
Yeah, it's a road trip. It's a road trip song. Mm-hmm. And a couple people take road trips in this movie. I didn't feel like they really landed what it was supposed to represent. Whereas
that's interesting.
What Push was supposed to represent was clear as day
and
driven home a couple times. You know, you mentioned the first time it was played. The next time is a bunch of guys playing it at their girlfriends.
Literally.
On acoustic guitar.
Like, not two.
Yes. But I felt like the Closer to Fine thing, it's like, it's a little bit about Barbie's journey. It's a little bit about mother-daughter bonding.
It's about camaraderie.
Yeah, but
it's about
did it work for you?
Yeah, to me, I saw the use of Push as like explicitly narrative. Did not see the use of Closer to Fine as explicitly narrative. To me, Closer to Fine was about the sentiment of being next to someone with whom you are sharing an experience, not the literalism of the lyric so much as the embrace that song. Like, that song is, I mean, I have been in crowds of 5,000, I mean, Indigo Girls at Summer Stage, 5,000 people singing along to Closer to Fine. Like, you will rarely feel more warmly embraced in your life than in a space full of people singing that at top volume.
Yeah.
A beautiful,
you're tearing up?
I'm saying, like, I mean, I remember being at like summer camps and this was playing. Like, this is a very, very time specific and moving song.
So maybe
I know that life of
the song, but I don't have that experience.
I will say, like, it's a little bit strange to see that song with like the mother daughter when the daughter like clearly is not going to know it, and then the daughter suddenly starts singing it.
Yeah,
like,
she sort of begrudgingly starts singing it. And it's supposed to signal their rift healing.
But to me, it's about the feeling, the shared sentiment and the shared embrace that song represents.
Right.
That's what it was being deployed as. Whereas Rob Thomas saying, I'm going to push you around, that's the joke.
Yeah.
But like Closer to Fine, it's not a joke. It's the minute you hear the minute you hear that, all I could feel was like pure inner warmth.
Yeah.
And having been around any number of people for whom that song represents that, that was my immediate association.
I hear that.
Not a pure lyrical.
Yeah. Read. And it's funny because as you're speaking about that, it reminded me that Greta Gerwig did something similar with Dave Matthews Band in Lady Bird.
Lady Bird, yeah.
Where it's like, where she says specifically, like, to some people, this song is a joke, but to me, it's like it brings me back to this time and place. And, you know, it was about it's sort of reclaiming.
How old is Greta Gerwig?
Greta's 39, so.
I almost feel like I came a little bit on the tail end of the generation for whom this song was. I felt like I had to learn a little bit about this song from older folks, but I guess maybe it's still resonant where Greta grew up or around or with who she grew up around.
Yeah.
But that to me, like, I agree on a pure narrative level, no. But on a, like, we're here, we're in this together, we are women engaged in a journey towards learning something, you know, and also just very powerful. And was still, to me, funny the third time.
Right.
Like, it wasn't just funny the first time. Yeah. It worked the third time, too.
And then there's the
if use there of, were three times, definitely three.
Yeah, I think two or three times.
I think three.
Then there's the use of Billie Eilish, which is sort of ham-fistedly used to represent feelings.
Yes.
It's like when Barbie says, like, I want to feel, they play a Billie Eilish song about,
like, most people
wanting to be a real girl. You know, like, it was
most,
like,
most people do that too.
Yeah, that's that not, felt that's a not little the Barbie thing. It felt a little shortcutty, you know. I thought the music direction in this movie, like a lot of the movie, was really up and down.
And also the balance of it, there were like the routine about, like, I'm just Ken, and all that stuff is in the second half.
Yeah.
The front half is so busy winking at you and setting up little bits that there's so much that the film has to achieve in the second half. I remember thinking, like, what, number one, why am I watching a 2-minute long speech? Why am I watching a 3-minute long musical routine? The routine where they're all of a sudden they're in like the modern dance world and
the final Ken number.
Yeah, yeah. Like, what, like, why wasn't that? It's okay if it's there, but why is it only there?
Yeah.
Why there, is there not
a
something
musical number in the first act?
But not but that. I didn't feel like it was that long or that narrative.
It wasn't
impactful.
Narrative important.
Yeah.
How does this soundtrack work for you as an album? I think that with the bona fide cultural phenomenon that the movie has become, there's probably an expectation that the soundtrack follows suit. It has all these big names, as you said, you know, original songwriting by Mark Ronson and Andrew Watt, like two big hit makers. And yet I don't know that it's really going to make it on its own as an album. Like, I wouldn't be surprised if Matchbox 20 is the real winner out of all of this. Even
and Indigo Girls.
And Indigo Girls.
Yeah, of course.
But I think Push is going to, if I had to guess, I think Push is going to stream higher than Indigo Girls
probably
next week.
Yeah, yeah.
Neither of which are on the soundtrack itself.
Sure.
Like, do you think that the soundtrack has legs on its own?
Not outside of the Nicki and Ice Spice record.
Which is wild, if only for Nicki Minaj calling one of her wigs the Bob Dylan.
Yeah, to me, the potential breakouts here are the Billie Eilish record, which, no, but
we've
it's
heard,
like,
we've heard this Billie Eilish song before.
But this, but it, those kinds of songs get nominated for Grammys.
Oh yeah, that's true.
So I think that the Billie Eilish song could have legs in a off season for Billie Eilish. I think the Nicki and Ice Spice song, essentially, it's like a KTUZ 100 record.
With the big Barbie girl sample.
Yeah, yeah, it's like very obvious. It's very like of the moment. But to me, you listen to the Barbie, you listen to Barbie World, and it sounds like it doesn't, if there was no Barbie movie, but this song was out, you'd be like, fine, this is what music sounds like now.
Yeah, unfortunately.
Literally is what it sounds like. The Billie Eilish song sounds like a Billie Eilish song that happens to have some Barbie reference. But like, I don't think like Lizzo's Pink is going to be like a crossover hit.
Yeah, and that's again more sort of, it has exposition for the movie. It's, it has a lot of jokes. It's not a pure pop song. And then there's the Charlie XCX song, which is sort of somewhere in between. It's like two or three interpolations piled on top of each other. It gets a lot of burn in the movie.
It's incomplete.
It's incomplete or overcomplete, but it's it's not working for me.
Yeah.
Despite her plugging it really hard on social media. You want to talk about some real hits?
Combination.
You want to talk about some real hits?
If there's one person who knows exactly how many hits they have, it is.
Yeah. Drake.
It's all a blur.
It's Drake.
Then tour with 21 Savage. Again, I saw the opening night in New York at Barclays.
I saw the opening night at MSG.
Right, about a week later.
Yep.
Okay. To me, the show felt like if such a thing as a Drake club walkthrough gig existed, that's what this was. Apart from the first 20 minutes where Drake's just like trying to remind you, like, yeah, I did all these sensitive records.
He starts with a deep cut set.
It's actually really, I was really moved. I was like, oh, we do Marvin's Room. Like, oh, yeah. Okay, phenomenal. Yeah. It's like, blah, blah, blah. I don't know why they start like that, but then 15 or 20 minutes in, it just pivots. And then it's punishing 90 seconds, hit. Pure annihilation. An absolute reminder that even though he's leaving 70% of his hits off the table.
Yeah, no Hotline Bling, for instance. Doesn't even need it.
No, not even a tiny bit. I felt like Drake wanted to attend a Drake club performance and realized he just had to make it himself. But a lot of what I felt like I was watching was his own enthusiasm at hearing his records. Didn't feel like a concert to me. And this also speaks a little bit to the nature of the stage setup.
Yep.
It's in the middle. He's not performing to the crowd in the classic sense. He's with the crowd. He's being touched by them as he's walking down
walks out, like
a boxer entrance, but he's walking down one of the staircases.
Who did he walk in with you at Barclays? Do you remember? He had two Yankees with him last night.
Was that
Giancarlo Stanton and Aaron Judge? But yeah, he's with the people a lot.
That's the whole sentiment of the show. And I think you enjoying Drake songs while Drake is enjoying Drake songs, that's infectious.
And the theme of the show is sort of, we did this together, me and you. You know, can you believe I made it here? I'm nothing without you. You know, pretty standard pop star fare, but Drake... You know, child actor, that's a part that's underlined a lot. You know,
They
play the Degrassi opening, you get snippets of Fresh Prince, you get snippets of Family Matters. And I think to Drake as thespian and performer, like, he really sells the earnestness of, like, we did this together, I'm nothing without you, you know, of gratitude. And I think you're right that he feels like he's giving both the audience and himself a gift together, and that they're one in the same. And yet
it also means you can do a tour without having to, like, rehearse choreography or do any of this other stuff.
Yeah. Like, Drake still has no dancers. He's not doing the sort of, you know, highbrow thing that Kendrick Lamar is doing now, which is like part performance art, you know, like, it's not conceptual. Yeah. There's some Jeff Koons like conceptual stuff, you know. Get it out of the way. There's the sperm segment,
yeah,
with a giant floating sperm. There's the bride, you know, with the long train on the dress. There's the manga girl
character with exaggerated body parts,
exaggerated features.
Yeah.
And then the whole time, sort of lurking in the back, is the giant
Virgil
Abloh statue,
yeah,
which he only draws attention to at the very end of the show.
I think Drake on stage is enough to hold interest in 90 minutes or 2 hours. The person I went with called the show, quote, mesmerizing.
He's mesmerizing.
Charismatic mesmerizing.
He's also never looked better.
Looks great.
He's aging.
I will say the outfit's a little bit strange. They're kind of like butcher apron.
For the second half of the show.
Yeah, like butcher apron, a little bit strange.
After 21 Savage.
A little bit odd.
Yeah.
But I understand there is this thing, certainly like post-Kanye, where you like, how do I turn this into some kind of like Coachella-like installation?
Yeah.
You know, I'm sure you'll see
post-Kanye and post-Daft Punk. Kanye is post-Daft Punk, yeah, but in that sense.
You know, and on Travis Scott. And so, like, I remember being when Travis opened for Kendrick on that first big Kendrick tour. I went to the tour opener. And Travis had, like, a huge bird, eagle.
Yeah, hawk or whatever.
Yeah, hawk, flying over the crowd and blah, blah. And I remember thinking, like, huh, this is like, wow, you're the opener, bro. Like, what are you doing? But it's like, now that's just par for the course.
Yeah.
Those things they felt confectionery to me. They didn't feel conceptual. Like, they just felt like, oh, we should have something else for you to look at.
Yeah.
And Drake himself, a lot of these shows recently, or maybe just pre-COVID, up in the sky, wandering, you know, like you're harnessed up and floating out over people, or there's like an elevated platform and you're rapping or singing from there. That's not really Drake. To his credit, Drake's not going to give you all those like bells and whistles. That's not really what he's about.
Yep.
He just wants to party with you. He wants to rap with you. He wants to party with you. He's not going to give you all that. But there is still the sense of like, how do we do something that's going to seem conceptual? How's it going to seem big tent? And that's what all that is.
And there are a lot of bells and whistles in addition to the stage decorations. There's the, you know, you alluded at the top of the show to the op cam. You know, you got a lot of like Jumbotron stuff. You know, there's a breakup cam.
Can I ask this? Why would you have something called the ops cam and show your fans on it?
Yeah, I guess it's a joke, but it's not especially.
You totally get that.
Yeah.
Breakup cam.
I got Jumbotrons for a second.
If anybody has a screen footage, grab.
Yeah.
Did anybody have a screen grab? Did anybody get it? Any
Someone texted me and was like, I just missed you on the Jumbotron.
If you have footage of Joe getting Jumbotroned at the Drake Garden show, please email us.
Keep it to yourself.
No, podcast@nytimes.com. Also, my DMs are open. Only for this.
Yeah. So I will say I've been to a lot of Drake shows over the years. I thought the last couple, Aubrey and the Three Amigos, which had a similar structure to this,
yes,
where there's a little break where the opener, although 21 Savage does not open the show,
right,
comes out for a mini
set. But it's a little like footnote-y. There. It's a tiny bit footnote-y.
Yeah.
And also I would say felt a little bit footnote-y.
Yeah. And
regrettably, and, much as I like 21 Savage.
Yeah. And the tour before that, like, there is something where Drake just has so many songs to play that it can like, you know, when you're just at 10 the whole time, it can get a little relentless. I thought the valleys of this show actually worked a little better. You know, he does the mini set in the DJ booth.
Yeah.
With some of the club records.
The air felt a little bit softer in the room when he was off on the side. When he was on the stage, it was just definitely like, oh, I'm going to pneumatic drill you to death with hits.
And there's some arrangements that I thought worked. It's an interesting moment in Drake because he's so dominant still. You know, Her Loss, Honestly Never Mind, like no matter what people, no matter how people sort of like scoff at those albums, like they all, there's at least two hits on both of them that you can still feel in the room. And like, but he's just been operating at such a high level for so long that you just, he almost has nothing to prove, and he's not going to reinvent himself.
No, and even with like the occasional
presentation,
and also even with the occasional whiff, like the poetry book, which is just like,
right,
like, I don't, what are we doing here?
Yeah.
Like
expensive Instagram captions.
Yeah. Like,
yeah.
But also not as good as the Instagram captions. So there's a little bit of that. You know, there's been some chatter recently about what interviews Drake does or doesn't do.
Right. He's done a bunch of silly interviews.
Yeah,
lately.
Like
somebody who's not spoken to the press in many, many, many years.
Right. And it's, and again, totally fine. But like there is something a little bit like head scratchy, like the Bobby Altoff thing is, I sort of get it. But also it's like it could be funnier.
It could
like,
be funnier.
It could be actually way funnier.
But it's a little bit revealing.
About where he is at this moment in life.
And personally, like, I think you see a side of Drake.
A slightly softer side, yeah.
And you see Drake trying to flirt, you know, like, you see, which,
the part
again,
where he's talking about, she's like, where's your son? And he's like, somewhere safe. Incredible line. Truly, truly, actually a great line.
I thought, you know, I was not really up on Bobby Altoff.
There wasn't that much to be up on.
I guess she was a influential mom TikToker early in her internet career, in 2020 or whatever it was.
6 weeks ago or whatever.
And she sort of like wiped a lot of that and reinvented as basically a comedy podcaster. You know,
rappers going on comedy podcasts. Weird week.
Yes.
Weird week.
Yes.
It's just if you know, you know.
Yeah. You know, I think it didn't go all the way to Chicken Shop Date for me, which I feel like
that's the gold standard.
That's the gold standard of these.
And to be fair, Chicken Shop Date now versus Chicken Shop Date 2 years ago, totally different proposition.
Yeah.
But it doesn't go all the way to like 2021 Chicken Shop Date.
Yeah. But I would say like I probably, you know, as somebody who's consumed a lot of Drake content over the years, like I probably learned more about how Drake carries himself and converses
in the current moment,
in the current moment from this new podcast interview, and little, just weird little details about his day-to-day life, like going to bed at 6:30 and waking up at 2:30. Like, yeah. Is that your dream schedule, by the way?
Yeah. I mean, it's yes, frankly. Yeah.
His taste in drinks.
What's in that?
Like passion fruit juice and watermelon juice and tequila.
It's a really fruity drink.
I know.
You know, just little stuff in a way where, like, I prefer this to, like, no shots, but like Zane Lowe, you know, which is another place that artists feel safe.
I totally agree. And again, this is a thing, you know, you see with Chicken Shop Day, you see it with Hot Ones.
Yep.
This is a long stretch of artists seeking to demonstrate some form of intimacy, some form of alternate identity through these non-traditional interview venues. Yep. That are they're journalism adjacent.
Right.
And Chicken Shop Day, I mean, there is, you know, the racial component that's kind of like the Clueless Blonde Girl interviewing a lot of black performers. Like, obviously there's something can be a little bit icky about that. Like, I think Chicken Shop Day more often than not pulls it off and has historically.
Those are very rarely about the work at all. Like, the Bobby Altuff one is about the work in a jokey way where she's like, I don't know Drake songs. Whereas, like, you know, Amelia is just not going to ask about your music, really.
No. Like, you could be any, like, literally, she could be just handed a person blind and it works almost as well. So there is, like, a little bit of that component that's always a little bit uncomfortable. But I think Drake is far enough along in his career that he's seeing the Bobby Altuff thing as, like, that's a track. That's like, I'm going to tell you, that's a track. In the same way that the On the Radar freestyle is a track, the Bobby Altuff thing is a track.
I wanted to draw the same line between the two, which is also that it's very Drake in the sense that he's playing talent scout. You see in between the lines of the interview, it's basically like he followed her first.
Yeah, of course.
And then that's how she got the interview.
Yeah.
She's sort of like, why did you follow me? And she's making fun of him for following 3,000 people, which I thought was a good little back and forth.
Yeah.
But it was him saying, like, I know who's going to be cool on the internet and I'm going to follow them first and then I'm going to get there first and I'm going to make them cool. Make them cool. Yeah, which
it's him getting on Versace.
Exactly.
It's all
and
this.
I'm going to be cool symbiotically with them because I found them early and they get my shine. And that's what you get with his relationship with Central C.
And also the important thing, the other parallel between the Central C thing and the Bobby Altuff thing, on the Central C freestyle, he's speaking that language specifically. On the Bobby Altuff podcast, he's speaking that language. You talk about Drake's versatility. We talk about this all the time, that he's someone who is an absorber, a sort of voracious consumer and repurposer of styles, aesthetics, modes, ideas, frameworks.
Accent.
Combination.
So,
you know, but the fact that he can seamlessly pull off this thing side by side with Central C.
Yep.
And semi-credibly, like in the 50 Rappers package, Earl Sweatshirt says, if you don't have a valid UK flow, getting dusted. And Drake.
And Drake's had a UK Drake flow said, for many
hold
years.
My, Drake said, hold my beer.
Hold my. He said, hold my passion fruit. Whatever it is in that big
hold
line.
Hold my Ribena. And he just absolutely did it. Killer. Same thing with Bobby Altuff.
Yeah.
It's basically like Drake is saying, I can be essentially a UK rapper or I can be an awkward alt comedian. And he can.
And he pulls it off. What he can't be, maybe? Poet. Drake has also made a point during this tour to sort of say, I never go away. Like, I'm never going to let you down. In fact, I'm putting out a new album soon. So
threatening every Thursday at midnight, Thursday into Friday at midnight.
Is For All the Dogs coming out. So I think we'll be talking about Drake probably more this summer, both on Popcast Deluxe and on regular Popcast.
Just like any normal day or week or month.
Yeah. So it's Drake season as it usually is.
Yes.
In the meantime. Cuss out a cop, spit in his face, stomp on the flag and light it up. Yeah, you think it's tough. We'll try that in a small town.
This podcast is supported by the Freedom From Religion Foundation. I'm Ron Reagan, an unabashed atheist, and I'm alarmed by the intrusions of religion into our secular government. That's why I'm asking you to join the Freedom From Religion Foundation, the nation's largest and most effective organization of atheists and agnostics, working to keep state and church separate. Phone 1-800-335-4021, 1-800-335-4021, or visit the Freedom From Religion Foundation at ffrf.org. Ron Reagan, lifelong atheist, not afraid of burning in hell.
Jason Aldean's Try That in a Small Town, the music video, which has caused a bigger backlash to the backlash than a backlash, but a little bit of each, yeah, for sure.
Also, no one in American history or Canadian history has ever pivoted like that away from Drake to something like this.
That's why we're here.
Yeah. So this is, look, this week's episode of regular audio only podcast is about this topic, this subject.
So you'll go way deeper.
We will be, boy, will we. So let's just talk about it from a chart perspective.
Yeah.
This Jason Aldean song, number one, it's not a good Jason Aldean song. We can have like arguments about, is Jason Aldean a worthy person, or is this song like morally reprehensible, or is this video morally reprehensible? As someone who's written about Jason Aldean a lot over the years, I remember going to like one of his first New York shows at BB King's like 100 wow. years ago, like a long time. I can say with confidence, this is not a good Jason Aldean song.
Nor was it being received as such when it came out in May.
It'd been out for 4 to 6 weeks.
More, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, before the video was released. That, as you saw, is, you know, it's red meat for the culture war.
Yeah, dog whistle AF. Getting heat for being filmed in part in front of a courthouse that's famous for a lynching.
Although then they pushed back and said that that's been used in like a bunch of like Lifetime movies as well. Like,
Protest footage, Black Lives Matter, also allegedly protest footage that is not from the United States.
Like literally like Google riot footage.
Yeah. So sure. Like the moral standing of the song.
Well, and also we'll get into it more. If you have it in you for an hour of that conversation, we've got something else for you. But what it did is it propelled the discourse around this song, propelled it to number two on the Billboard Hot 100.
From
nowhere.
From nowhere.
Pure nowhere.
From irrelevance.
Yeah.
To number two in the country.
So because fans, or I don't even want to say fans, advocates, people who are single issue voters.
Yeah. Don't tell me how to think.
Yes, this happened with Morgan Wallen as well.
Though never as explicitly, because Morgan Wallen didn't make the work about the culture war.
And also, with respect, like Morgan Wallen's music is of a higher quality than this. This is purely people are being activated via right-wing news channels and media to say, hey, if you want to support these causes and these ideas, buy the Jason Aldean song, stream the Jason Aldean song.
Yeah, but buy the song on iTunes, something that nobody does.
Except for this particular constituency and K-pop fans.
Right. So the funny thing that happened here is that this song, in any other week, basically, would have skyrocketed to number one, but was blocked.
Worrisomely.
Yes, worrisomely, but was blocked in this case by, as you said, another constituency known to run up the numbers via streams and downloads in support of their faves.
This week is real Ben Cesario core in terms of, like, I feel like there
the
was
mechanism.
In terms of, like, I feel like, so Ben works with us, he writes our chart stories most weeks, and often he has to explain how a song or an album became number one, and as people find new ways to game the system, Ben, like, very dutifully says, like, hey, I see you gaming the system, and I'm going to talk about it.
With a deep sigh.
Yes, and this week, two system gamers phasing off.
So should we play the number one song in the country?
We can. This we can play it every day of the
Jungkook
week.
Jungkook featuring Lotto.
Again.
Seven. You like the song?
I like the song upon which it is based.
Okay.
And I can confirm that this song is based on that song.
Which is?
Saturday Love, Sherelle, Alexander O'Neill, shout out Minneapolis, a great song of my parents' generation.
This one is not the first K-pop song of the year to debut at number one because of the dedication of its fans who, you know, stream like it's their jobs and buy downloads, which count a lot toward chart placement because, you know, ideally that represents
more committed form of, well, I don't even know what.
I mean,
consumption.
If money changes hands, the industry rewards that because the industry is in the business of making money.
Yes.
So, yes, buying a download, which is not a practical way to listen to music at this exact moment, is good for your chart points. So, funny that we think of, you know, modern K-pop fandom as having a sort of political activist component. And in this case, I didn't notice them mobilizing specifically against the Aldine song,
right?
But it had the same effect, which was to block a pro-vigilantism song from being number one. And I guess I just wonder if now country radio like gets behind the Aldine song. Like the thing I guess that really pushed the backlash to the backlash into action was the banning of the video from CMT, which like what even like how long is the video block on CMT and what are the ratings for that?
This is not a real punishment. But the thing that is happening about this song, and it's and maybe it's different from Wallen a little bit. It's forcing people, not forcing people, it's the domino effect is that some people are choosing to take sides.
Yes.
Plenty of people are remaining silent because that's what they do. But you have the Jason Isbell retort, you have the CMT thing, you have certain people who have been activated against Aldine. And then you have people who are activated against the people who are activated against Aldine. And even though you saw this a little bit with Wallen, like Wallen, to your point earlier, was not making culture war songs. This is, despite Aldine's protestations, this is a culture war song. And so what's happening is certain people are feeling like they have to stake out positions in response to or in reaction to opposed to this. That is going to have a much more interesting afterlife than, frankly, this particular song.
At least when we had real war songs like Toby Keith's Courtesy of the Red, White, and Blue, like the music was good.
Genuinely, like Toby Keith out here looking like Springsteen
compared by comparison. To
I don't even like Springsteen like that, but like, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
out here looking like Dylan,
but I
also don't like that much.
When you say looking like Dylan, you mean the Bob?
Yeah.
I guess I wonder, like, was this a momentary push while people were paying attention, or does this song now become the country song of the year?
Well, I think what you're likely to see are certain radio stations in certain markets essentially, I don't want to say being forced, but finding it in their interest to lean into this messaging. They're already essentially saying, look, country radio is notoriously problematic. They're already essentially saying, hey, we're not interested in dissent anyway.
Right. Yeah. I mean, look, culture war is big business. Like, I think even going back to Barbie, you've already had you have people going to see Barbie as a feminist statement. You have, you know, the Ben Shapiros of the world making YouTube videos anti-Barbie because they know that gets views. You know, the Aldine thing is similar. And I think if anything, you're right, it incentivizes work like this.
Maybe this is a good opportunity, since our question of the week is also about controversy and how certain artists have courted it or been subjected to how other people perceive their engagement with it.
Right.
Should we talk about this?
Go in. This is anecdotal.
And well, first of all culture, all questions are anecdotal. So as I was walking to the studio today, James Thomas, who works with us, who I've known for a while, literally runs after me and says, I need to ask you, did you have to fight hard to get Violent J from Insane Clown Posse into the 50 Rappers package? So we did the 50 Rappers package, as I'm sure you know, a lot of heavy hitters in there. It's Gucci Mane, Lil Wayne, Eminem, 50 Cent,
yeah.
Cardi B,
yep.
Eve,
like
Q-Tip, like LL Cool J, DMC. Yeah. Like,
go read that if you ever read
honestly, it. nytimes.com/hiphop50. Just it's set aside an hour and really dive in. A lot of great stuff in there. Violent J is in there.
Yeah.
Some people might say Violent J is not a rapper. Some people might say Insane Clown Posse is not valid in this context.
I also got this question over the weekend. How'd you get Violent J in this thing? Why? Et cetera.
Did we have to fight hard to get him in the package? Like, was it subject to a lot of debate? So on and so forth. Was it a challenge to actually achieve? So let's talk about that a tiny bit.
Yep.
Violent J, when Insane Clown Posse was first making records in the 90s, I went back and listened to a lot of those records, thinking about if Violent J should be in this, and if so, what role is he playing? If you listen to a lot of those records, they don't sound that radically different from other rap music of the era. I think current ICP doesn't sound like current rap.
Yeah,
it sounds like older rap. But older ICP sounds like older rap music. It's not that different. And who ICP was influenced by, you know, there's the obvious folks like Isham, who's like a hardcore pioneer in Detroit, a local legend. But also, you know, he mentions Ice Cube, he mentions Awesome Dre. Like, there's other folks who are like more straight ahead rappers. If you listen to The Great Malenko, maybe you're hearing Cypress Hill in there. Like, there's a lot of stuff that feels very familiar if you are willing to grant it a little bit of critical remove and kind of assume that it, and not assume the worst about it. We wanted to tell a story about hip hop that was expansive. And one of the things that came up in the Violent J interview was how excluded from hip hop history he felt that his music and that scene had become. And I think totally understandable how perception has hardened over the years. But when I was going back and listening to those old records, I was like, wants to be in the conversation. Maybe doesn't quite know how to be in the conversation, but wants to be in the conversation. He told a bunch of stories. There's some funny ones. He mentions that they had offered Ice Cube $100,000 to do a verse for them at some point, and Ice Cube like said no or like didn't get back to them.
Yeah.
And then later, Ice Cube gave him a verse for free just out of respect, and that blew his mind. But to me, the most memorable story that he told, he conjured this scene. It's 1994. It's Toledo. So Toledo apparently is one of the cities that ICP is huge in.
Right. I think it's important to note that the way that ICP is thought of now is as meme and as cultural phenomenon.
Right, because the Juggalos, the SNL skits.
Yeah,
like,
the Magnets song, you know, the music of ICP.
Cast a lot.
And especially...
How does it work?
Yeah, and especially ICP as rappers have that conversation has long been left behind in favor of... The makeup and the festival and the crazy photos of people doing wild stuff there. And part of what we wanted to do with this package was ground it back in the music and the history. So I think it was crucial for that. But yes, Toledo, a Juggalo town.
Yeah. So one of the things he kept saying, he said this, it's early in the text of the interview. He's like, you know, we're huge in Detroit and huge in Toledo. But like, if we went to Pittsburgh, like no one would care. So it's like there's a very, very, very concentrated
Juggalo Alley, if you will.
That's good.
Yeah,
that's the next book.
Yeah.
So he conjures this memory of being on a bill with Outkast and Coolio in Toledo in 1994. Now just
think about that. Think about who goes to that show. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. And he says very sincerely, we were honored. We were honored to be on a bill with these groups. And what happened is ICP is the opener, I think.
Yep.
And if you have ever been to an ICP show or an ICP affiliated show, certainly in the Midwest, you are probably familiar with Faygo. Faygo is local soda that has an ambivalent relationship with the Juggalos and ICP.
But they don't have an ambivalent relationship with
Faygo.
Yeah.
I as a person with currently two flavors of Faygo in my fridge right now. You know, just for special occasions. You actually got me one once, and I keep Peach Faygo just on deck.
The coolest thing I've ever seen is Faygo Seltzer.
Wow. Never.
Just straight.
Hilarious.
Yeah, right.
Great.
Yeah.
Great. That's put it literally like bronze it.
In a
like
museum.
Put it on the air. Yeah, absolutely.
Put it on stage at the Drake show.
So ICP goes on. Faygo's the place up. You know, shaking right, the bottle, like a, spraying everything.
Like a F1 race celebration.
Right, except champagne. It's the opening act.
Except it's the opening act and it's soda.
Right. Now, this sounds great to me, but maybe if you are Outcast and your very expensive equipment is on stage.
And now sticky as hell.
Maybe you're not that excited. So Violent J tells a story of essentially being pressed. I wish we'd interviewed Violent J before Big Boy, because I'd be curious if Big Boy has any memory of
definitely
this.
Not.
Or Andre, God forbid.
Yeah.
Getting pressed, but he doesn't say Outcast. He says Outcast guys.
Yeah.
Who knows? Who knows who
and is. The point he was making is that it's basically impossible for them to play
or with real rap bills. Rap. Right.
Because they can't open for anyone, let alone rappers.
No, and they can't headline. Because he also brings up, I forget, is the Snoop thing in there? Right.
Yeah.
He says we did a show with Snoop, but Snoop had to go first, and that sucked because then everybody left.
Yeah.
So they're in this kind of catch-22. Yeah, total catch-22, right? And Outkast pressed him.
Yeah. It was like, and they had to pay to clean our equipment.
Right, pay to clean everything or pay to replace. Again, he seemed genuinely heartbroken. Like, it was actually, like, real, like, I was like, this guy just wants to be, he wants to be embraced.
A tough memory for him.
Yeah.
That he got to play one show with Outkast and it went horribly.
Now, and I'm going to say, like, I was moved by that story. I felt bad. I felt bad for Outkast for having to replace all their stuff. I felt bad for him for getting pressed. And he literally says, like, we just want to do our thing. Like, we don't want to hurt anybody. Like, we're just, like, we're about embrace.
A common misconception about juggalos.
Yes. Now, that said, there's one small thing in my head where I was like, did this happen?
Right. Is this an apocryphal tale?
Right. Like, you know, is this like sort of like a patchwork of three different
Which
things?
Runs through the whole package. Part of the fun of doing as told to's is
fun.
Some people
fun in heavy quote marks.
These are people's memories.
Individual memories.
Yeah.
But so
they
I just
contradict
like,
each other.
You know what? Let me just type this. Let me just type ICP, Coolio, Outkast, Toledo into Google and just see what happens. And you know what happens? This happens. Someone on eBay, based in Toledo, selling photocopies of old flyers for rap shows and other shows, I think. Coolio, Outkast, misspelled, ICP at the Toledo Sports Arena, August 26, 1994. If you want to know what the villain origin story for anybody, this is where it starts. Shout out to whoever sold me this on blue paper.
Like I said, they should have just sent the PDF.
Literally. So exactly. I could print it out myself, but I appreciate you packing it so well. I am grateful to have this. I'm going to frame this and hang this in my home office.
It's really cool.
Yeah, it's very cool.
And that's why we included Violent J in the 50 Rappers Project.
Thank you so much. Do you hear any good songs this week?
Yeah, I just got a little rap song for you.
I'm sure you do.
Some acrobatic flows.
A Joe Coscarelli special. I did say earlier before we were recording, I did say it is baffling to me that at the New York Times, there is a two-person talk show about music heavily, not exclusively, but heavily.
Yeah.
And I am not the person picking the weird rap songs. That's weird. That's strange.
Strange.
You know what that is? It's progress.
Yeah, it's growth for both of us. Valet featuring Z Money.
Incredible.
His best collaborator. The new Valet Harry Fraud mixtape is out. The song is called Uppity. Valet, really interesting guy. Profiled him a couple years ago. Strangely got signed to Def Jam.
It's a weird moment.
Via Good Music.
Yeah,
it was a weird moment. Didn't work out.
He's off now.
Yeah, I think this project was released independently. He's been putting out music in sort of low-key collaborations that seem to be getting around his label deal.
Yeah.
But now he's free to be a freak, basically, which is what he is musically. Does not like to adhere to song structure or beat structure or word. You know, he's
the 51st rapper.
He's the 51st rapper. He's an abstract painter.
Actually, if we told you who the 51st rapper is, we're not going to do it.
Yeah,
someone ethered themselves.
Yes, there were 51 interviews done for 50.
Someone ethered themselves. If you guess right, well, I don't know, we'll give you a snack or something, but someone ethered themselves.
These two guys have a couple songs together. They have one called 216s from a few years back that was ripped off sort of ad nauseum, and both just extremely devoted to seeing how they can lay their voices over a track in ways that haven't been done before, which because of our recent mindset is something we're invested in. Off-kilter flows. Song's called Uppity. Just been playing it a lot in my headphones. Yeah, and my motor hot. Yeah, and I'm in 2 G's. Yeah, and it comes too cheap. Yeah, this shit wasn't cheap. Yeah. What a 30 pop. I put fours a lot. Help my girl crop. What do you got? This is rap music. This is a different kind of flow.
Okay, so like, to talk about this song, we have to talk about the Spotify New Music Friday playlist.
Okay, unfortunately.
I want to apologize, as I always do, to Liz Pelly when we talk about Spotify and how occasionally Spotify will surface something, or something will be surfaced via the algorithm or via the playlist coordinator using the algorithm. Like, with all the caveats. What's that? Scrolling through New Music Friday, I saw there was a Gaslight Anthem and Bruce Springsteen song.
Right.
Like the final, like the, it's like really the final boss for the Gaslight Anthem.
Right. Which, as I said to you before we started recording, very painful that Gaslight Anthem got the Bruce feature after Bleachers.
Strange.
Like, that's gotta hurt.
If you're arcing New Jersey bands, yeah. Like, I mean, for me, it's Gaslight all day.
It's gotta hurt if you're Gaslight Anthem. Anyway, but, that's so, not your song of the week.
It's not my song of the week, even though it's fine. But I sort of like my eyes like landed on it and I said, okay, well that happened. Okay, great. And I sort of my eyes like wandered up one in a song called Buckle Bunny. It's like Buckle Bunny. That's a, what a wild name. Never heard of the performer, Tanner Adel. Press play and boy, does this song go. Tanner Adel is a black country singer, although the music obviously tilts a little bit more pop and a little bit more R&B, but Buckle Bunny, I mean, I'm not going to say it's going to go full munch, but as a sort of catchphrase, this is good. This is a good, funny, inside baseball, like a lot of lulls in this song. I'm on board 100%.
Do you want to define Buckle Bunny or you want to let the song do it?
No. I most assuredly do not want to define Buckle Bunny. In fact, I that would end
you
the show.
You will not.
Yes, that would end the show. That said, Tanner Adel is happy to do it for me. This is Buckle Bunny.
To raid the pantry?
You better. Unbuckle thyself. We got a snack with a love note.
Yeah, we got a special snack submission.
Yes.
This is from Kimmy Sai.
Yeah.
Kimmy is an art director here at the New York Times, been helping us out with the show.
Yeah.
When we started, sent us a little pile of goodies.
Mm-hmm.
We're finally getting around to them. These are HBAF, honey butter almonds.
And what does the note say?
This is Kimmy's review. She says, this is unhealthy and addicting.
Great.
Just like any other snacks.
Right, but it looks, you know, from a distance,
yeah.
I wouldn't necessarily identify that as like a sweet, addicting thing.
I think that's what she's saying. Yeah, I think
it's getting like maybe like Trader Joe's. Like,
yeah, but she's like, don't worry, it's not healthy.
Yeah, right. It's giving like quasi healthy, but it's not. How's the smell?
Almondy. These are honey butter almonds.
That's all it is. It's just coated almonds. Oh, really coated? So not slickly coated with honey butter.
No, like dusted.
Dusted.
Right.
Oh my God, it smells like popcorn. It smells like movie popcorn.
With a little shell, a little candy shell. It's really good.
Oh, damn.
Yeah.
Oh.
Kimmy.
Oh, man.
Kimmy, you got one.
Oh, I'm so frustrated.
So you're just going to eat too many of them? Make yourself sick.
I already have a headache.
Yeah. But in a good way, worth it. These are delicious. I wish I had these at Barbie last night.
This is a perfect movie snack.
Yeah.
It does have a little bit of movie popcorn, like.
Yep.
You know that, like.
Caramel corn a little bit, like a Cracker Jack.
You know how when you get a lot of butter on movie popcorn, there's something lightly rancid about it?
Yeah. Delicious.
No. In the best way.
Yeah.
This has that.
Yeah.
This is it. 8.5, 9? I'm gonna say 9.
Let's go 9.
This is a 9.
This is a mutual 9.
This is the first
thing we've agreed on.
At this level.
Yeah.
Man, Kimmy.
Delicious.
Kimmy.
apologize for exposing me to this. I really don't want to know this exists.
They're really.
That snack is why we do the snack. That's why we do the snack content.
Yeah, for a eureka moment.
Something that's new to both of us, genuinely shocking to both of us, and like, unfortunately, now going to be a gastrointestinal problem for me for years to come.
Yeah, exactly.
I need like a damp, moist towelette to like, it's going to be a problem. That is our show.
Yeah.
Beautiful. Every podcast ever is at nytimes.com/podcast. Podcast Deluxe, John and Joe, is on YouTube at youtube.com/nytimes. The audio version of this is also available on the main podcast feed. Email us, podcast@nytimes.com. Ask us questions. We answer them. I mean, you don't just simply have to run up on us in the office. We'll answer them if they come in by email or the Discord or the Facebook. It's tinyurl.com/podcastfacebook/podcastdiscord. If you want a t-shirt, we're getting some t-shirt orders from last week. It's thepodcast.myshopify.com. Joe, it's us. Sawyer Roque is producing. Leslie Davis is executive producing. Special thanks to Nell Galogli, Karen Gans, Pedro Rosado, everybody in the video department. We'll be back next week.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.